Welcome to Cybermania, cyber talks with the brightest minds in cybersecurity. Discussing risks, AI, emerging threats, workforce challenges, and more. With your host, May Brooks.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Cybermania. With me today is Ami Hoffman. How are you, Ami? What's it like down under?
Good. Thank you for having me. Monday afternoon over here. Supposed to be the later part of summer, so it's still pretty hot.
So what does the future hold for us?
Well, what is the theme at the moment in the market? And on a personal basis, I'm just trying to, you know, I'm a half glass full kind of person, so I always see the positive angle.
So that's what happens in the next 6 hours? How many hours ahead of you are you? I don't know, six, eight? I don't know.
I think it was 7 hours ahead. It's 6 p.m. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so 6 hours. Yeah, 6 hours. Nice. Okay, so Ami, as always, we start this episode with you telling us a little bit about you, yourself, and your crazy story in cybersecurity. So tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, I consider myself an industry veteran. Been around almost 35 years. I've been a client. I always joke about this being on the dark side, but I'm not sure which side is darker than. But I have been a client for about 20 years, been a CISO in various different capacities. I spent the last 15 years in a consulting advisory capacities in massive organizations, mostly in group global capacity. I've traveled different geographies. And recently, I established my own business, focused on bringing innovation closer to market, spending time with vendors and clients, trying to solve complex business problems, and just trying to have fun after many, many years of, you know, working big corporate environments.
Well, you definitely earned it. So you had such an incredible journey. And I think we first met about, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago when you were still the CISO of one of Israel's largest telecom companies. And something I always wondered, I don't think I ever asked you, what makes a person that already sort of reached the top in their career, you were working for a huge company in Israeli terms, what makes a person in that position make the move and move to the other side of the world, literally to Australia?
It's a very good question, and you know, need to unpack this. Personally, I always had the urge, you know, I wanted to go and conquer the world. I wanted to do things exciting. There was a business drive. You know, the Israeli market is fairly small. There were opportunities, but I always had a dream and go and work the bigger markets. My first priority in my intent initially was to go to the US. My wife was not as excited. So we had various different discussions. We had an angle. Her sister has been in Australia for many, many years. And, you know, when I arrived at Australia, there was a huge opportunity in terms of talent, in terms of maturity for their various different organizations. So from a business perspective, there was an opportunity for me to do things that are quite different. And we talk about, you know, some of the differences, but certainly do something different in comparison to what I've done before. There was also the personal drive, right? You know how crazy life can be in Israel. We had two kids at a time. The younger one was born in Oz. I was just looking for a better work-life balance and just an opportunity to reinvent myself. Actually, you know, we left the country, no work, no nothing. We got the visa, we got the paperwork, you know, took the luggage, took the two kids, jumped on a plane, arrived. I had a friend recommending what used to be the biggest SI in region at the time. I was fortunate enough to... The biggest financial organization just failed a massive audit. They literally didn't have a security program. So I ended up spending 4 years building a security program for a tier one bank that was competing across the region with the large, you know, German, UK, US banks. That was fascinating. And, you know, from there I moved within the corporate. So it was a good experience.
That's so amazing, because your relocation, my relocation experiences are very different, because I came, we already had a job here, we had a house, like everything was settled. But I think that one of the things that people that never experienced relocation don't really understand is you have about 2 years, at least for us, it felt like the first 2 years, that everything is new. Wow, this is the first time I'm going here. Wow, this is the first time I'm participating in this conference. Wow, this is the... So you suddenly in your 40s and you have a year or a couple of years of firsts. And that is unique. I actually absolutely love that experience. And as you said, you worked for global organizations, not just in Australia, but in Israel as well. Can you tell us a little bit about the main differences that you have seen over the years, how cybersecurity is perceived in different regions in the world?
Yes, absolutely. Maybe start with a quick personal story. When I arrived, I think nowadays we have quite a large and established community of ex-Israelis. In Australia, we have something called Global Talent, which is an accelerated mechanism for people to come over on an expedited process to get a visa, which wasn't the case when I arrived. We had specific projects, whether it's Elbit working with defense or Amdocs working with the national telco in pockets. My first project with the bank was basically to build a SOC, build the tool sets, build the processes, take it, operationalize this. My first submission was a 300-page document, which took me a few months, and it's a very
It's
mature process.
pre-ChatGPT days.
Yeah, it's
We actually had to write things.
pre-ChatGPT. It's a very mature process with various different gates, and you need to get a sign-off in each gate. And I still remember, and funny, the guy that was sitting in the gate, he's actually a CISO, and I met with him recently. I reminded him of this story. When I submitted the paper, his first comment was, "Paper is okay, but your English is average." And when I left Israel, I thought, my English was okay, but you come to a different geography, people measure you based on various different, they have preconceptions, you're an immigrant, you come with this funny accent. Regardless, you have to forget everything you know. Different approach, different methodology. So I think for me, I'm a risk taker, personally. I like challenges. I like to challenge myself all the time. And this was just an opportunity to build resilience, come back the next day and show him I can do better, improve myself. You asked a question about some of the differences. I think the biggest difference when I was a CISO, I'm a techie in nature. I really like technology. As you grow your career and you move up the stack, you can't spend time, in the details. This is why you need a good team around you to delegate. Obviously, as a leader, you expect to lead the pack, but you need, a good team around you. I was still able to maintain a good balance in Israel, and I spent, a substantial amount of time across the technicalities with, key vendors, with my team, looking at, design, high-level things that, I really enjoy doing, brainstorming around potential ways to solve, complex problems. It's very different. I made a decision when I arrived to Australia whether I would like, to pursue a such a role or not. Decided not to. I realized the role is very different, a CISO, and it's quite similar in the US and most major markets in Europe. It's mostly, risk and finance, and it's mostly, upwards stakeholder management. I think it's much worse nowadays. Most CISOs, they don't get the support, they don't get the funding. In many cases, and I'm speaking to CISOs, on a daily basis, they're concerned that once something happens, they're just going to be used as an scapegoat regardless. I'm still hearing from clients, nothing major happened in the last 5 years. Why should we invest in cybersecurity? It's just an expense. So being a CISO is very difficult. The other thing I didn't have in Israel, and you would remember how it was. We used to squeeze the vendors to, to implement the solution and give us some level of support, all within, one implementation cost. There was no real awareness for, the need for professional services, advisory services, pay for to get access to an experienced person to help you build strategy and such. Everything was done in-house, so very different over here. You learn there's a structural methodology. I just described, this life cycle, how you take a project through production, from classifying the assets through building a control library through getting the sign-offs before anything goes into production, very strict procedures around, change controls and such. And the fact, the ability to manage 50 million or $100 million projects across, 30, 40, 50 countries. This is something I almost dreamt about doing. Didn't think I'm going to get the chance, operating out of Israel. And it's all good experience. And I was fortunate enough over the years to go to almost every corner of the world. And you see the differences, differences in cultures, differences in how they conduct business, conduct themselves in front of clients, engage with technology vendors. It also presents challenges because, again, just as one more story, when I had worldwide responsibility in NTT, one of the key focus areas was to try and consolidate. We brought McKinsey as an advisory firm, and we were laughing because one of the things, to give you an example, they did an analysis. They said, as a large MSP, the average in the market for various different SLAs is 4 to 5. You guys have 450, right? The business was so bespoke because NTT was a multinational conglomerate comprised of about, 45 different companies. The approach was always, custom bespoke. What a US client wants is very different to what a British client or an Aussie client or an Israeli client wants. What they ended up doing is building various different flavors of a service. What we ended up doing is just bringing everything, back to square one, t-shirt sizing, standard. If the client wants bespoke, sure, but it comes with a price, trying to move away from bespoke. Again, this is all golden, exercise. That this is exactly, part of the reason why I left, my original role and what I wanted to do all along.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And you mentioned a few things, a few nuggets that I want to point out because you mentioned quite a few things that are so important. And one of them is how different the approaches and the CISO role is in different parts of the world and how cybersecurity is perceived by the stakeholders. And we had that conversation a few days ago about how I see it. I've seen us as an industry, and I believe that as an industry, we have to mature sort of like the IT industry at the time from a cost center, something that is a sunken cost.
Yes.
Unfortunately, a lot of leaders still see cybersecurity, and I can't really blame them if I'm completely honest. A lot of leaders see it as a sunken cost, something that they do out of fear, because they don't know what will happen if there's an incident. And then there's an incident and nothing that big happened. So they said, wait a minute, did we waste all that money for nothing? So I think that is part of the maturity that we have to undergo as an industry, looking at things from the business point of view and trying to find ways where cybersecurity can positively impact the business bottom line. I'm not sure I'll be able to find a way, but at least that's the hope in the doctorate. But you also mentioned the different perspectives of CISOs in different parts of the world. And as someone who's been a CISO in quite a few organizations and worked with CISOs all over the world, what do you think makes a successful CISO today? What sort of, how does this role evolve over the last 30 something years that you've been around?
It's a beautiful question, and let's unpack this because it's a really complex question. There's no easy answer, by the way, and the journey is not a straight line. And I think as an industry, you're correct and more to it. I think as an industry, we completed a circle not for the first time. And I just spoke to a colleague. He said, if you reflect on the 20, 25 years back, have we as an industry made any progress? I don't think so. I actually think we went backwards
Great.
for various different reasons. First, there's differences based on geographies, and there's business differences based on industries. That's the first aspect. For example, if you look at the US, there's the emergence of cybersecurity subcommittee. It's an autonomous body that reports directly to the board. And I heard this for many, many years from the board and from ExCo. We're being treated like the enemy. We're being kept in the dark. We don't hear the full story. People just tell us what they want us to hear, and vice versa, because I heard from exco's when they come to present to the board, we've been grilled, we've been held accountable for something, we've been screaming about for many, many years, but we never got the support, the funding, the attention we've asked for, and now something happened. We've been, held accountable, and it's really been an arm wrestling for many, many years. Outside of the U.S., and it's a really humbling exercise. I got to spend, and you see the differences. Entity, for example, is an SI. They engage mid-level IT leadership. Accenture is very different. It's strategic advisory. You engage exco and board, and you see this on both ends. I spend time with excos preparing for board presentations, and you would be amazed. I still see large organizations without specifying names, reporting on the number of vulnerabilities they have in the environment. It's not
And
telling any
which
story.
vulnerability is telling the
Yeah,
board
it's
the
not.
CVE?
Yeah,
Why
it's
would
a,
the board
there's.
care?
And I'm a big, so my approach to it is I'm a big believer in storytelling, and make it simple. Most of the board members, they're not technical people. They don't understand cybersecurity. They understand business. They understand legal aspects. They understand finance aspects. They understand risk to a point when it comes to business risk. They don't understand cyber. And to be a good leader, obviously, you need to be able to take a very complex problem and put it really into layman terms. But you also need to be able to tell a story. When I'm saying tell a story, there's two things in here. One, where am I today? Okay, and there's always a question. I heard this often. Like, I'm a pharmaceutical organization. I'm not a bank, so don't come and tell me what Citigroup is doing because it's not relevant to my business. I need references that are relevant to my industry, to my geography, so that you bring this into context. And the unfortunate reality is they would never have appetite to do more than the average. But certainly if you're trying to align them with relevant averages, whether it's based on geography or industry, or whatever you slice and dice this, then they're going to be interested in most cases. But you also need to be able to demonstrate progression. Now, this is interesting because, for example, the leading pack were what I call the risk-averse organizations, the banks, the large insurance companies. They understand risk. They know how to mobilize these type of projects. I started seeing the change 5 or 6 years ago when market disruption, number one, changes to consumer preferences. Everyone want to consume services on the mobile. Changes in the workforce. Generation one, Generation Z, now in the office, want to work remotely. Don't want to come to the office 5 days a week. The environment is expanding. They've been asked questions. I had cases where technology was purchased by a CFO or COO, right? Because they wanted empirical data supporting they have return on investment. I was speaking to CISOs, they were saying leadership is grilling us. Like, you got 10 million, 20 million over the last, 1 year, 2 years. What have you done for it? So, if I look at the times where I was a CISO, it was enough to say, I spent $5 million with Cisco. No one was asking questions. I think you need to be able, there's a saying that cybersecurity have become a data problem or a data, exercise. It's exactly the case. Even when you go in and present to the board. When I did this exercise with the CISOs and other CXOs, this is how you build this. Think about the narrative. Think about the data points you need to demonstrate the narrative and demonstrate progression ongoing, then figure out what you need to do to fulfill those data points, because it's all, you need this data to be able to tell a story at the end of the day.
Exactly.
And there's
And
one
I
more thing, the last one, last but not least, which is the cultural change. Okay, where again, when I was a CISO, it was a star model. Everything went through the center. You had to rubber stamp everything. Now there's a change of forces. I realized this 2016 or 2017, the big hype was zero trust. For example, so my company invested, we decided micro-segmentation as part of Zero Trust. That's the area to invest. There were various different investments. This is where I learned first time that budget for this, shift into the traditional monolithic architecture that is now moving to cloud initially and now moving into a full microservice, micro-segmented environment. The budget is with someone else, the head of digital or head of application development, whatever the role is, including the security components. A CISO is influential, so they come to the CISO to provide some oversight and help them with requirements, but it's not for the CISO to rubber stamp, specifically if the CISO's approach is going to slow down the business. So I think that was a long answer, but the skill set from the CISO is very different. It's about, creating these business alliances. It's about being able to articulate very complex problems in layman terms. It's about, leading the business on a very, different path, very different skill set today.
It is, and I couldn't agree more. I think that today, when we're talking about when I train CISOs, when I deliver CISO training or CISSP, and I talk to them about things like communication, some of them, especially those coming from a very technical background, are looking at me like, why are you teaching us communication skills? Because those will prove crucial down the line. And then I talk to them about metrics and setting goals and measuring, and they're looking at me. That's a business question. No, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And if you can't explain to management what you've done with the budget, to your point, then they're not going to give you an additional budget next year because they ask you, what did you do with the last one? But you also mentioned something very interesting for me because you talked about innovation and the fact that sometimes the business owners will come and ask you to implement innovative technologies because they understand that the world is changing. And how do you balance? Because there are always constraints. There are business constraints, there are budgetary constraints, there are regulatory constraints. And on the other hand, you're a very technical person and you love innovation. How do you balance those things out? Go for that new and shiny object. No one said AI for about, I haven't said AI for like 10 minutes, so I have to say AI. But how do we balance between innovation and risk in today's super connected and super fast-pacing world?
There's various different aspects you need to look at. The first aspect is what I call compliance-based versus risk-driven. You know, as a professional, that compliance-based tick the box is not going to keep you safe. The regulator is still going to push you, and your board is still going to grill you if you missed ticking the box. So the unfortunate reality is I see many organizations, and depends on the market. So, European Union is a good example. US is another good example. Australia is not as regulated. There's a big push for more regulations. Depends on the industry and where you operate. There's lots of various different regulations. In most cases, it's a starting point. It reflects industry best practice. The larger organizations would use some sort of a mix-up, things like NIST, SIMS, like HIPAA, and build some, where it makes sense. Look for some common grounds. But you need to bear in mind this is only, the starting point to build some good hygiene. Make sure you align with industry best practice. Then, on top of this, there's a million other things you need to do. I would say 10 years back, there were lots of areas that were unexplored territory, whether it's cloud security or data security. So it was easier to push innovation, because it was a new concept. I still remember the days where, Check Point and Palo Alto announced next generation firewalls. It was a new thing. You implement this feature, and now all of a sudden you can look at, all various different layers of the communication. The current market conditions, because of what I've described, the global talent shortage, disrupted markets, cost pressures, and everything else, and this is across the board. I'm speaking to CISOs across various different geographies. Going to market to buy another technology is difficult, right? You have to submit a business case. You have to demonstrate that, you know, it's either addressing a gap or you're going to collapse a number of controls or do something else. There needs to be some narrative behind this, not just go and buy the next shiny tool. Now, with that said, I'm okay with that. And this is something the market should have done years ago, to be honest, because there were quite a few sites that they were in continuous, you know, chase about chasing
the
next the
new
shiny,
shiny
tool.
Thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Tool. And I think what...
But who will manage all those tools? That's always the problem.
Yes,
you buy another tool and another tool, and no one can manage them at the end.
And surely you've seen some of the recent news from the U.S.
Yeah.
There were various different mechanisms to, let's say, to encourage some of the CISOs to take the next shiny tool. I'm putting this aside. With that said, what I still see is many organizations continuing doing what they've done in the last 20 years, regardless of the fact everything has changed. Everything has changed. The culture, the process, the technology, the way people connect change. Good example, and this is why I'm a big advocate of CTEM as an example. I still spend time with many, many organizations who spend a lot of money on traditional tools, and I have respect to all of them. You know, whether it's Qualys or Tenable or Rapid7, they all, you know, have good people in terms of chief visionaries and chief technology officers. They understand where the market is going. All of them go beyond just, you know, simple scanning of the environment. But if you look at the process, it's creating a massive backlog. There's no business, you know, context there. There's no way to prioritize this. They just flick it over the fence for someone else to resolve. There's no real, you know, sense and appreciation of what needs to be done first. This is why remediation is not done.
So
and
let's
if you
explain
also
a second.
Look under the covers, you know, developers don't have security KPIs. It's complex. So what I'm trying to say is innovation can still help you. But what I think what the market needs to do is to go back to some of the traditional paradigms and rethink, you know, those elements from scratch. There's, you know, other examples in SOC transformation in other areas.
So I want to go back. I want to go back and explain what CTEM is, because I'm guessing that at least some of our listeners have no idea what you're talking about. So, yeah, so that's why I was cutting you, because CTEM is basically continuous threat exposure management. And I think it would be a good opportunity to explain a little bit how this is it's not a new, but new-ish approach to risk and threat management.
Yes. So traditional approaches, you know, whether it's vulnerability management or penetration testing or other application for many years were, you know, were quite static, right? It's a point in time, fragmented. It's done on a certain, you know, periodic approach. You know, it gives you part of the picture. It was very hard. You know, many, many organizations, it's dynamic. I spoke to a CISO not too long ago. You know, he was describing the situation where you might have a team that, you know, have spun up some environment in a cloud environment they have because they need to run progression testing for a new version that goes into production. This environment only existed for a few days. It's not registered to a CMDB. He had no appreciation that this environment exists and what the risk associated, right? And then it's scraped. Look, you know, there's a few examples for us, a few recent breaches where this is exactly happened. Someone fed fingers, there was environment unmanaged, shadow IT, someone made a mistake, and, you know, an adversary have used this. CTEM, although CTEM is not based on new ideas, the basic approach, first, it stands for continuous threat and exposure management. And, you know, Gartner have introduced this idea in 2022. Gartner is talking about five different ongoing stages. But basically, there's two elements. It's a continuous appreciation of risk and exposure. It talks about, you know, testing and validation. It talks about understanding the, you know, the true scope of assets. We have lots of examples of things not managed in a central CMDB. You have industrial devices, you have cloud devices, you have shadow IT, rogue devices, lots of examples. So, you know, understanding the broader sense of your digital footprint, measuring, you know, your risk and exposure on a real-time basis. So if you take the same example of a backlog, a SITM approach would help you understand, one, what are the most critical elements in your environment, why they are critical. For example, and I use this example many times, you know, if you have an externally facing website with five known vulnerabilities, but only one is associated with a tool that was used to exploit this, why would you treat all five as equal? And this is the whole exercise of being able to multi-layer, you know, marketers have been using things like CVSS for many years, which is rudimentary. The whole thing is to overlay
put
the
it
conversation,
in the context.
Put it
in
into
right
business context.
Exactly.
And focus on the most critical things and ongoing. It's an ongoing exercise. And the other element is everything you and I know for many years, all the traditional risk management exercises were all treated as technology initiative. And CITM is a framework that for the first time brings business and technology together. And I had a few posts about this in LinkedIn. It's all about creating business bridges between technology and the business, those alliances. You have to find people to come on a journey with you, because as a CISO alone, you're not going to win this.
I couldn't agree more. And I've been saying for years that probably the best thing I've done for my cybersecurity career was to actually have a business degree. My MBA was actually...
Yes.
It's probably helped my career more than even professional trainings, even CISSP, that I have so much respect for the CISSP, but the MBA enabled me to create those bridges, to have those discussions in a real profound way. So you want to? I want to ask you, as someone who works with so many leaders in cybersecurity, not just CISOs, but what would be one piece of advice that you want that you would give people, either already leaders or aspiring to be leaders, if they really want to make an impact in this industry?
People as human beings are scared of change, okay? And it's different times. And I've seen many organizations, you know, employing the wrong people or putting wrong people in the wrong jobs. I think number one is about leadership. It's about leadership. Lead by example. Spend time with the team. Empower your team, as opposed to delegate. Empower your team. Build a framework that will enable them to learn and thrive. People, if you look, now, surely you've seen many reports. So most people don't leave a job because of salary, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, satisfaction, they didn't have the ability to grow and learn, you know, bad leadership, you know, other reasons. So obviously you want to create the right climate. It's a team sport, right? And you need to create the right climate for people to grow and learn. The big organizations, they all have vehicles to take people on the journey. I don't think they're doing this, you know, efficiently enough, but it's certainly the thought process is right. It needs to be a mixture of experienced people. People have been in the trenches for many years, and young people hungry. And, you know, focus on diversity. If you have a team, they all come from the same background, it's just not going to work. I remember when Microsoft were one of the first organizations, you would remember this, because in Israel, they had different locations.
Yes.
Some people sitting in, you know, in Netanya, some people sitting in Herzliya, some people sitting in Tel Aviv, based on their function. And one of the, and this is Setia, you know, along the analogy of a round table where the equality, everyone has an equal voice around the table, he started moving people around, mixing developers with salespeople, with other, just to create this culture of, you know, diversity and integrated, as opposed to working in traditional silos.
It's interesting
And the
that you
other
mentioned
thing,
diversity because today there's so much pushback against diversity. And I always said diversity has nothing to do with who you are or your gender or your age, or it's just we need diverse thinkers. I don't really care if
agree.
you're a man or a woman or you come from a development background or from, I don't know, social studies background, but we need diverse thinkers because we need to bring those diverse ideas into the table and think like our adversaries are thinking. They're bringing our adversaries come from all walks of life. So I think it makes us
Agreed. And
rounder teams and rounder people being exposed.
I fully agree. It's diversity is not just about gender or ethnic background. We certainly need diverse thinkers. And the last one is call it change agent. Specifically in large environments, you would find lots of roadblocks, political people for job security, for whatever reason. There's always an opportunity to find the change agent, and this is as an advice for leaders. This is what I said: look for the change agent. For example, we spoke about the fact that most organizations, application developers, don't have secure KPI. They're measured on time to market, lines of code, quality of code. They're not measured on how many vulnerabilities they have in their code. And coming with broad statements around we need to change, people are going to push back because they're measured in a certain way. Find those people that are willing to come on a journey with you, educate them, spend time with them. Those change engines. And there's always, in every environment, there's a change agent, people that want to do things different, people that want to improve, people that are willing to go back and rethink about all paradigms. And it's not easy. But
Nope.
that's the way for you to be successful.
It is. You know what I want to ask you? You've been doing this for over 30 years and you're so motivated to this day, and anyone who follows you or talks to you sees your passion to learn and innovate and grow and change with this industry, in this industry. And I want to ask you, what motivates you to keep pushing forward? I mean, you could have just taken a cozy little role and relax till retirement and everything, and yet you keep pushing and keep changing and doing new things. So what keeps you motivated?
I think there's two things. First, for many people, it's just a day job. I'm really passionate about cybersecurity. I like this. I enjoy what I'm doing. I feel blessed in a way, at least for the most part of my career. I was blessed to be surrounded by intelligent people doing, great thinkers and lots of exciting things. I was involved with. I also want to leave some legacy behind. I was always aspired to do something to, to change the world. And I know, it's a big statement, but I use this often in my posts, is create a safe environment and what we're leaving behind to our kids. So, I look at some of the dropping socialized skills with the younger generations and the lack of appreciation and understanding of some of the cybersecurity challenges ahead of them. I certainly want to be able to change some of it.
It's beautiful. Yeah, passion. And I think that almost for everyone in this industry, because it's so diverse and it has so many different aspects, you can find your passion, even if you're not sure what it is right now. And for those listening, I wasn't sure. For many years, I was doing cybersecurity because I sort of found myself in cybersecurity. I liked it. It was interesting. I enjoyed it, but I wasn't passionate about it. And I decided to find my passion in cybersecurity. It was a decision. It took time. It took exploration. And I know some people, when they hear someone like you, and I know you had a similar story, and a lot of people that I talk to, myself included, that people think, oh, you were fortunate. It just happened to you. No, it didn't just happen. I created it. I was very intentional about finding my niche and finding my passion in this industry called cybersecurity. It could have been any other industry, I guess. I don't know. I like cybersecurity. That's what I do. So, you know what? I will ask you before we go to the rapid pop quiz part Bart, I want to ask you one last question, big question. Looking back at your career, was there a specific moment or a specific decision that you can pinpoint and say, wow, this was a turning point in my journey?
Certainly, to move to Australia was a turning point, and I came from a very conservative background. Spent many years working in large traditional environments like the Israeli Electrical Company and Rafael. You know the mindset. I left the environment at the early bubble days. I was the first B2B exercise established in Israel. I was always looking, but this was a big change, and there was a lot of uncertainty. We jumped on a plane, and suddenly, a career changer.
Amazing. Okay, well, I mean, this was such a wonderful conversation. And before we wrap this up, we always have this rapid pop quiz that we do. Short questions, short answers, whatever comes to mind, no right or wrong answers. Are you ready?
Yeah, let's go.
Let's go. So let's start with, if you had a magic wand and you could solve one cybersecurity challenge, what would it be?
I would say create a magical sock that, adapts to changes in the organization without, turning the knob five times over.
I like that. I would take that magic wand and use it for sure. What's the most unexpected skill or hobby that had nothing to do with cybersecurity and yet helped you in your career?
Mentoring, for sure. And
Mentoring or being mentored or being the mentee or both?
Mentoring. Obviously, I have had lots of people mentoring me, and I was fortunate enough. But I think being a good mentor is not something you learn in school. I was, again, fortunate enough, having worked in large organizations. You are expected to be a mentor, and I, other than my MBA, was my first opportunity to learn some of the principles, and then I took some formal trainings as well for the large corporates. I think the most humbling exercise I participated before I left Accenture was to we hosted about 50 high school students from really struggling areas. This is a suburb where parents can't afford good schooling and such. So this is part of community volunteering. We hosted them for a nice day in the office, having spent a full day with the kids talking about future. There were so many things they didn't know about life because of their backgrounds and what they've been taught. And being able to, mentor people of all backgrounds, not just the traditional, corporate environment, kids. I got to do this in front of, kids and teenagers and students outside of this. I think that was probably the most compelling skill I've learned outside of, technical skills.
Beautiful. What's the most unexpected place your cybersecurity journey took you to?
Probably Sweden.
Sweden.
Yes.
Well, I've been to Sweden, but not for cybersecurity. I'll have to do that as
Yes.
well.
My experience was interesting. We landed in Gothenburg. Sweden, because of the acquisitions, NTT acquired a company called Secord, and Secord had a very large SOC in Sweden, and larger parts of the R&D team still exist in Sweden. I went there to spend my time. As I arrived to my hotel, I went to freshen up, and I was supposed to leave the team for dinner. I couldn't leave the hotel because police have closed all boundaries. I then realized as I was entering the hotel, someone jumped off the roof.
Oh
Yeah,
my God.
that was my first experience. Yeah,
Are you a fan of Sweden now?
it's a very different, It's quite a depressing exercise. It gets docked at
It does.
3 p.m. Very, very different motivation for the team. You still find pockets of innovation and, good talented people that are motivated, but the general, population is driven by other things. But again, I was fortunate enough to be various different parts of the world. This was probably one of the most bizarre experiences
Okay.
I went through.
How do you celebrate your achievements?
Giving my wife and kids a good hug.
Oh.
And I still probably the most important person that I value the feedback is my mom. My mom is
Beautiful.
89, and I actually got her to listen to a recent podcast I did. And I was
Nice.
so anxious. I got feedback from multiple people. I was so anxious just to hear what my mom thinks about this.
Oh yeah,
So
I can relate. I can relate for
this is the
me.
best way for me to celebrate.
Yeah, for me it's my dad. My mom passed away, but my dad is my biggest supporter and my biggest critic and the one that I
Yes.
really need feedback from. Okay, so last but not least, I'm going to challenge you. If you can send a message to the cybersecurity community 10 years from now. I like challenging people.
I'm trying not to be cynical because I would probably put the note in the lines of you shouldn't rush your way with AI.
Fair enough.
Because I think the way it's going to get out of control very soon, and we have to slow down progress in many respects. There's so many things they haven't thought about, and at the moment we're in a rush. And maybe if I had an option B, I would just say just keep the world safe, because unfortunately, again, it's not the emphasis. It's not first thing in mind for many leaders. And we need to keep a better balance so that we create a safer environment for everyone.
I love that. I mean, thank you so much for joining me today. It was such an
Pleasure.
inspiration
I enjoyed.
and I enjoyed it too. I think you have so much experience and thank you for sharing it with our listeners and with me. And I hope to see everyone here next time on Cybermania. Don't forget to subscribe.